Hello, this is Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 11th, 2025. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. Today's feature story is about bikers helping kids, but before that we turn to the transparency page, where the first article is titled, Joanna Allhands, Digital Opinions Editor, Navigating Journalism and Arizona Water Policy by Catherine Jerkas. Joanna Allhands was born and raised in Indiana, where she cut her journalism teeth. But her dream job was writing opinions for the Arizona Republic. And in 2004, at the tender age of 24, Allhands somehow convinced the editors to give her a shot. She's been here ever since, initially opining about Mesa and Tempe, then overseeing the Southeast Valley Opinions pages. She moved to her current role as Digital Opinions Editor in 2012. Question: who or what inspired you to pursue journalism? Answer: I wish I had a good story about this. I had a great uncle who wrote the famous headline, "Ford to City, Drop Dead." But even though I learned about that headline in journalism school, I didn't know he was responsible for it until I was well into my career. I decided in eighth grade that I wanted to be a journalist, not because I had some idealistic notion of telling people stories or uncovering the truth, but mostly because I enjoyed writing. I cold called every media outlet in my hometown for summer work, and after my freshman year in college, and landed, seriously, I don't know how, an unpaid internship at the newspaper. Everything fell into place after that. What does a typical workday look like for you? Oh, it's generally chaos. Just kidding, but I do wear a lot of hats. Editing my colleagues' work and submissions from the community. I write headlines and do all sorts of things to make our content look good and be found by others online. In my spare time, I write opinions about Arizona water policy. It sounds nerdy, and I suppose it is, but I am passionate about our water supply because there is no more important issue to a desert state in the throes of drought. And if we don't have water, we don't live here. And I don't know about you, but I like living here. Editorial content is a backbone for so many newspapers. What do you feel sets your work and the Republic apart from the rest? I'll leave that answer to readers. But my goal, at least, is to explain complex water issues with clarity in hopes that it will help folks form their own opinions. As I often say, it doesn't matter if you agree with me. What matters is that you know whether you disagree or agree because of X, Y, or Z. The key part is because of X, Y, or Z. In case you're wondering what drives my points of view, it's simple. I deeply believe that our state's diverse water uses, be it farms, new development, or factories, are all valid. I also deeply believe that if these diverse interests work together, meaning they must sacrifice together, they can survive long into the future. And if they refuse to sacrifice and compromise, well then, we're all in deep trouble. What is your next goal you want to achieve? Gosh, I've pretty much accomplished everything I want to professionally, so anything else that happens is gravy. That said, it would be heartening to see some major compromise legislation pass on groundwater. And by compromise, I mean creating rules that no one loves, but that everyone can live with. I also have my fingers crossed that I don't totally lose our shorts in the Colorado River after 2026, and two, that the fight over water doesn't end up in court. The next piece is titled For Those Who Protect Children by Sean McKinnon. Back in 2012, Republic storyteller Karina Bland and photojournalist Pat Shanahan introduced readers to a group of bikers. Honest to goodness, Harley riding, leather wearing bikers who volunteered their time helping the most vulnerable among us, kids who had suffered abuse or trauma. The 11-year-old girl hears the rumble of their motorcycles, rich and deep. Long before she sees them, the story began. She chews her bottom lip, nervous. They are coming for her. The story of Bikers Against Child Abuse struck a chord with readers who fell in love with the Pipes and the Ito and the Animal and Rembrandt, the names the bikers took for their work with the kids. Bland, who still writes about kids for other readers, would later write that it was one of her favorite stories ever, and she heard from readers in the years that followed who drew inspiration. Earlier this year, Republic storyteller Lane Sainty got in touch with some of the people in that original story, including bikers Nioto and Rembrandt, and some of the kids whose lives the bikers changed. "I'm not a real big joiner," Rembrandt told Lane, but after seeing the change BACA could elicit in a child, he knew he was in it for life. "Once you witness that, and you're part of that," he said, "there's no going back." You'll read Lane's story in today's Republic. It's our Mother's Day offering, not strictly about mothers, though there are some in the story. It's about how grown-ups can help turn life around for a child, make them feel safe and loved, just like Mom. Samantha, one of the children introduced in Karina Bland's original story, said everything didn't magically get better after the biker showed up. It took time, but they helped put her on the road to recovery. Sometimes she works with kids who went through what she did, and she listens and remembers her first meeting with the bikers, and she knows what they are going through. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms and all the other people who make us feel safe. Joan Miners brings us a story titled "Climatologists Reel as Trump Delays Report." Congress has mandated regular assessments. Hundreds of American scientists who volunteered their time to help produce the congressionally mandated 6th National Climate Assessment, due out in early 2028, received an email April 28th from the Trump administration. "At this time, the scope of NCA 6 is currently being reevaluated in accordance with the Global Change Research Act of 1990, it read. "We are now releasing all current assessment participants from their roles." The series of reports is the result of an act passed by Congress during the George H.W. Bush administration in response to testimony in 1988 by scientist James Hansen that global warming was already worsening droughts and heat waves. Hansen told lawmakers to stop waffling and deal with the problem. So they voted to mandate that a national climate assessment be produced approximately every 4 years. Past national climate assessments have synthesized the best available scientific understanding of how storms are intensifying, heat waves are becoming more extreme, crops are increasingly failing under the strain of drought, and pests that shift into new regions in response to rising temperatures, and much more. The information is then translated into layperson summaries, maps, and graphs, and distributed to stakeholders and communities where it can be used to inform policy and preventative measures designed to protect American lives, homes, businesses, and wallets from the supercharged forces of a warmed atmosphere. Now, the second Trump administration, near the end of the first 100 days, environmentalists say will devastate public lands, wildlife, and climate progress for generations, has halted this volunteer effort signed into law by a Republican administration 35 years ago. The move is another example of President Donald Trump seeming to follow guidelines as set out in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 blueprint for his second term, which he distanced himself from during his campaign. The document highlighted the report as climate alarmism and an obstacle to the president's scope of decision-making related to projects or initiatives that could pose additional climate risks identified by the scientist authors. It is yet unclear what legal challenges may follow. Multiple Arizona State University law professors did not answer the Arizona Republic's inquiries about what it means that this dismissal violates a congressional mandate. Arizona Attorney General Chris May's office also declined to comment on plans to file suit, but shared through spokesperson Richie Taylor that May's is deeply concerned by the Trump administration's ongoing efforts to undermine our ability to confront climate change and will continue to fight back against illegal actions taken by the president that threaten Arizona communities. What is clear is that patriotic American climate scientists are dismayed. The announcement Monday dismissed the scientist authors of the 6th National Climate Assessment from their roles on the report, not their jobs, as other outlets indicated. But the Trump administration had previously fired staff involved in coordinating the effort through the U.S. Global Change Research Program. This makes it difficult for plans to develop for the assessment or near-term future opportunities to contribute or engage, as the April 28th email suggests might be the next step. It's incumbent upon us to call out the reality behind the rhetoric here, David White, a professor at Arizona State University and director of the Global Institute of Sustainability and Innovation, told the Republic. The climate assessment has, for all intents and purposes, been canceled. White was the lead author on the Southwest chapter of the 5th National Climate Assessment, which was published in late 2023 and celebrated by President Joe Biden. He traveled to the White House for its release that November and said being appointed to the role and in attendance at its release were some of the greatest honors of his life. "It is a patriotic duty and a patriotic responsibility," he said. "Many of us, including myself, are incredibly proud of that. These folks are doing this out of service to their country." That sense of American service stands in sharp contrast to Trump's treatment of the report as a political attack. White said the scientists involved actually take great care not to make sure the process and findings are conservative, not alarmist, and based on robust scientific evidence. "Contrary to the way it is being framed by this administration, this is a policy-neutral, bipartisan effort," he said. "The goal with this report is to help every sector of society, all Americans, red states, blue states, manufacturing, agriculture, farming, ranching, as well as environment and health. It is really one of the most patriotic things I could imagine," he continued, after a pause to reflect. "Like the Manhattan Project that brought together the greatest minds of a generation to unlock the power of the atom to help to try to win the Second World War, this is bringing the best minds and talent of universities and nonprofits and government partners together to come up with the best knowledge we have about responding to this incredible challenge that we face." Unlike the secretive Manhattan Project, however, the 5th climate assessment, which White noted was still available online at the time of the interview, offers a level of transparency not seen in most other government reports. He described it as a very dynamic set of chapters, all hyperlinked to each other so that any interested individual can follow the logical thread. The 2023 version includes an online interactive atlas that allows people to look at specific projections for a particular geography, like their own county. It is easy, probably, for people to think of it as just another report that the government produces, White said. But it's really designed to be something that empowers people, communities, businesses, farmers, ranchers to be able to understand and anticipate impacts. It also, importantly, does not recommend specific policy actions. So the idea that it might have some embedded bias or climate alarmism is really, I think, just rhetoric from the administration to undermine the credibility of what is really authoritative scientific consensus, he said. White was not involved in the preparation of the current 6th assessment. He said it's normal for scientists to step back for a cycle since the report can require 10 to 20 hours per week for several years on top of their regular jobs. Instead, Elizabeth Cobelli, who grew up in Mesa and is now an expert on Colorado River policy and a faculty member at the University of Nevada, Reno, was set to lead the next Southwest chapter. She told the Republic she was heartbroken to receive news this week that all authors had been released from their roles on the 6th assessment. "The Southwest chapter authors, which I lead the selection of, are true experts in their fields," Cobelli said. "They had already put so much work into exploring the scientific advances that have been made since NCA5. I'm devastated to lose the opportunity to work with that amazing team and to engage with communities across the Southwest to support climate resilience. What Americans and Arizonans stand to lose. Americans, and in particular Arizonans, may feel the lack of a sixth update to the National Climate Assessment. Cobelli noted that the Southwest is ground zero for many impacts of climate change, particularly threats to water security related to aridification, a term for the shift from temporary droughts to more permanent low rainfall conditions. She also pointed out the Southwest has been a key testbed for innovative climate mitigation and adaptation actions, progress that may be stalled without continued work on the report. The absence of a national climate assessment that meets the report's historic standards of broad input, rigorous peer review, and transparency has serious implications for the nation and especially for the Southwest region, Cobelli told the Republic. If decision makers and stakeholders do not have reliable, up-to-date information on how climate change may impact the region, their ability to respond suffers and in turn negatively affects all residents. White identified three specific examples of how the fifth assessment released in 2023 has already informed local strategies regarding Arizona's water resources and extreme impacts. He said he received requests to present the report's findings and how to access data from entities managing the state's water supplies, including the Phoenix Water Services Department and the Salt River Project, one of Central Arizona's major utilities. The city used his input to inform their decision-making about smart investments in water infrastructure, and SRP factored his knowledge into plans to manage Arizona forests and sensitive watersheds. He did this work for Phoenix area officials as a volunteer. White also said he thinks ASU professor and sustainability researcher Jennifer Vanos' contributions to the fifth assessment review of the toll extreme heat takes on outdoor worker productivity and therefore Arizona's economy have already informed local efforts to address this hazard. In her innovative news section of the report, Vanos illustrated how the increases in both average and extreme temperatures that are projected based on a very complete and solid understanding of how climate change is impacting heat in our region anticipate significant reductions in the ability of farm workers, utility workers, those in construction trades, and more to cope with extreme increased temperatures, White said. We anticipate that this will be reduced by up to 20 or 25%, and so this information is incredibly vital not only for those frontline community members, but their managers who need to understand how they can reduce risks to their workers. Last April, the Phoenix City Council passed an ordinance requiring employers who work with the city to draft a heat safety plan that ensures access for their outdoor workers to free and cool water breaks as needed, access to shade or air conditioning, and that helps employees adapt to the heat. That rule just went into effect May 1st. A city spokesperson said they were not aware of any direct connection between the fifth climate assessment and this new ordinance, but the advances in understanding of heat made by ASU climate scientists have been integrated into many official and unofficial ways with the evolving operation of Phoenix's Office of Heat Response and Mitigation. Vanos, for her part, is not convinced that all hope is lost for a future sixth national climate assessment. She thinks there may still be some fulfillment of the congressional mandate, just different from what had originally been lined up. She uses the latest report in her class at ASU on climate and health and would miss having access to more recent data and insights to share with their students. But she remains confident that the lasting value of the 2023 assessment to which she contributed. She said she continues to learn from it, and the report is making a big difference in the scientific world and beyond, where its complexity, derived from reliable data, critical thinking, and traceable connections to climate change, can still support decisions about infrastructure needs and coping resources for exposed communities in forward-thinking ways. I feel for the government staffers for who this was not a volunteer task, Vanos said, but I am reminding myself that the NCA 5 report, as well as the specific sections by location and sector, including the data, maps, and graphics, are still valuable to many people, communities, cities, farmers, and beyond, because they are. Joan Miners is the climate news and storytelling reporter at the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com. Her award-winning work has also appeared in Discover Magazine, National Geographic, ProPublica, and the Washington Post Magazine. Before becoming a journalist, she completed a doctorate in ecology. Follow Joan on Twitter at @BEECYCLES or on Blue Sky at @JOAN.MEINERS, bluesky.social, or email her at JOAN.MEINERS@ArizonaRepublic.com. You can listen to your favorite Sun Sounds program on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org. Click the link titled Broadcast Info and Audio. Underneath that, you will find programming links and a link to on-demand podcasts. I think maybe we were all expecting something like this next article from USA Today titled A Chicago-Style Pope. Windy City brings home the papacy with native son, Pope Leo XIV, by Michael Loria. Over 100 years passed between World Series championships for Cub fans in this great city, but they finally got one. And now, after a mere 2,000 years, they've got a pope, too. This town is in heavenly abuzz with having the first United States pope in history, Pope Leo XIV, hail from their city. Everything dope, including the Pope, comes from Chicago, Mayor Brandon Johnson posted on X. We hope to welcome you back home soon. The Wiener Circle, a famous Chicago hot dog stand, celebrated with a sign that read, Canis Nostros Ipse Comit, Latin for, He has eaten our dogs. The Onion, the Chicago-based satirical publication, declared that the conclave had selected its first Chicago-style pope, with a doctored pic of Leo in Chicago-style hot dog bun, which, God forbid, did not have any ketchup. The condiment is strictly forbidden on hot dogs in Chicago. The man, formerly known as Robert Francis Prevost, was born in 1955 at Mercy Hospital, about 3 miles south of the city's downtown loop. The Cardinals elected him, of all people, to lead 1.4 billion Roman Catholics around the globe. Not the bitter rival Cardinals in St. Louis, the ones in the Vatican who chose him as a successor to Pope Francis on May 9th, barely a day after they were locked away inside the Sistine Chapel for the historic conclave. Throughout the city and social media that day, Chicagoans quickly embraced the United States' first pope as a cultural icon, with memes and altered photos showing Leo holding Chicago hot dogs and other city food favorites. Chicago loses mind over homegrown pontiff, read one Instagram post. Photoshopped images of the new pope wearing Chicago Bears, Cubs, or White Sox garb made the rounds. Both the Cubs and the White Sox used their lighted scoreboards to announce the pontiff supported their team. The south side of Chicago is White Sox territory, the Pope's brother John Prevost told WGN-TV. He was never, ever a Cubs fan, so I don't know where that came from. He was always a Sox fan. Their mother, however, rooted for the Cubs. Despite that brief tussle, Cubs and White Sox fans alike were ecstatic for the new Pope, who was raised just south of the city and whose early life revolved around the south side church his family attended. They toasted Da Pope, a reference to the Saturday Night Live Da Bears sketch, and choked that in place of the wine and bread at Mass, the world should expect Malort, a bitter liqueur knocked back as a rite of passage in the city, and deep dish pizza or tamales. But it wasn't all memes and games. There was a lot of hope blowing through the Windy City as well. Chicagoans are fiercely proud of their city's working-class reputation, and Leo has a reputation in the Catholic Church for sticking up for workers' rights and the disenfranchised, something highly valued here. In this time when Chicago has been demonized, when workers' rights and immigrant rights have been attacked and people feel in fear, it's symbolic we have a pope from Chicago who is actually also a dual citizen. It shows solidarity among countries and workers, said Alderman Byron Cingo Lopez as Southside City Council member. Leo chose to obtain dual Peruvian citizenship during his many years serving there. "It brings hope because Chicago is a beacon hope for the country," Cingo Lopez said. "It's very symbolic that we have one of our own up there." Chicago, dubbed the City of Big Shoulders by poet Carl Sandburg, cheered that it may have a working-class champion to stand up to President Donald Trump's criticisms of the city over the years. In his first presidential term, Trump called Chicago a haven for criminals. "That is embarrassing to us as a nation," and he threatened to send in the feds. In January, Trump's border czar said Chicago would be ground zero for mass deportations, and city officials braced for a showdown. The new pope brings some optimism that the city has an ally in a high place. "Hopefully it's going to be a factor in fighting back," said Sarah Izquierdo, 30, who runs a medical clinic frequented by migrants on the city's south side. "Francis was really good at standing up for people, so I'm really hoping we see the same courage in this pope, too." Chicagoans noted the name of the new pope took an apparent reference to Pope Leo XIII, who was known as the Pope of the Workers. The turn-of-the-century pope outlined the rights of all workers to a fair wage, safe working conditions, and collective bargaining, the Chicago Federation of Labor announced. "We are excited by this message sent to workers around the world and look forward to Pope Leo XIV presiding and serving people of all faiths." Cingo Lopez rode into city council as a champion of working people and echoed the boasts of Chicago Federation of Labor. "People have encountered him as someone who can truly reflect the aspiration of workers," the alderman said. "I'm proud to have someone like Pope Leo XIV who reflects those values." The Reverend Michael Flager, the longtime pastor of St. Sabrina on Chicago's South Side, is known nationally for his anti-violence work. He said the unexpected choice of a United States cardinal could not have come at a better time. "As I look at the world and the immorality going on with fascism and tyranny, we need a voice of moral conscience and concern for the poor," Flager told USA Today. "What a great time for an American to be in a position of a moral voice." Leo's moral voice, he expects, will be distinctively that of his native city. "He has all the right ingredients. He comes out of Chicago, which is unique to the country. The big city with the small city feel," Flager said. "This city is the heart of America. It's real people, and it's got the issues of a city, but it's a place where people try to do right." Advocates for immigrants were particularly pleased that Leo appears to follow in Francis's footsteps in championing them. Celine Wozinska was at a Catholic church just outside Chicago, where she helped run a free store and legal aid clinic for migrants when bells began to ring. She took heart when she learned which cardinal prevailed. "He came from a working-class neighborhood of Chicago, so that gave him a good start," said Wozinska, 71. "But he's so identified with workers and marginalized people of Peru that he added Peruvian citizenship." Wozinska cites he's about 600 migrants a month. In recent months, staffers shared the words of Francis to console people entering the doors looking for help. She expects in Leo, the people she serves, will have a new beacon of hope. "We got guidance and strength from Pope Francis's words, and I think we'll be able to continue to give strength and guidance through Pope Leo," she said. "He's definitely going to keep up the passion for the rights of human dignity." Izquierdo, who runs the Southside Medical Clinic, said that since Trump came into office, her medical clinic has had to screen people to make sure they are who they say they are, and not immigration and customs enforcement agents looking to make an arrest. "I'm hoping this will alleviate some of that anxiety that is rampant right now," she said. "There's a lot of fear in going to a food pantry or a doctor." Izquierdo, a Chicago native whose father is from Peru, saw only one glaring flaw in the new pope. "I heard he's not a Cubs fan," she said. "Can't have everything, I guess." Contributing to this article was Jordan Mendoza of USA Today. This is Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 11th, 2025. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. You can listen to Sun Sounds on our mobile app, available for both Android and iPhone. Before we turn to our feature story, we have an article titled, "How Senators Kelly and Gallego Have Voted on Trump Nominees," by Ronald J. Hansen. Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego voted against Frank Bisignano to head the Social Security Administration in another party-line confirmation vote, deepening their records opposing most of President Donald Trump's job picks. But the opposition, coming from both Arizona Democrats, rests heavily on second-tier nominees who serve as deputy secretary or as an ambassador to a foreign country. Both Kelly and Gallego were more deferential to Trump in the 19 early confirmation battles that settled who was running major government agencies from the outset and a few other key positions, such as head of the FBI. In those 19 cases, Kelly voted yes for Trump's picks 7 times, or 37%. Gallego did so 9 times, or 47%. In 41 lower-profile nomination votes, such as the one May 6th involving Bisignano, both Kelly and Gallego were less supportive. Both backed 26% of those Trump picks. Overall, Kelly has voted to confirm 17 of 60 Trump picks. Gallego has backed 19 of 60. As Democrats, the country, and in Arizona, stew about how to slow an agenda many of them despise, the confirmation votes reflect the party's limited power after losing the White House and Senate in last year's elections. In early February, several chapters of the Democratic-aligned Indivisible Group gathered outside the Phoenix offices of Kelly and Gallego to complain the pair had been overly accommodating of Trump's nominations to that point. It was only weeks into the new administration, but already about halfway into confirming Trump's top advisors. All 60 presidential nominations that have been received a vote by the full Senate have been confirmed by the Republican-led chamber. In the 19 votes for Trump's closest advisors, the nominees received an average of 63 yes votes, easily enough to pass, according to an Arizona Republic analysis of Senate voting records. In the other 41 confirmation votes, the nominees averaged 57 yes votes, still enough to pass, but with fewer Democrats. Kelly and Gallego have usually agreed with each other on Trump's picks. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was the first member confirmed and found the broadest possible support. The former Florida senator breezed to confirmation with a 99-0 vote. Both Kelly and Gallego voted to confirm Scott Bessent as Treasury Secretary. He received only 68 votes overall. Kelly and Gallego split on 2 of the 19 key picks. Gallego voted to confirm Chris Wright as Energy Secretary and Brooke Rollins to be Agriculture Secretary. Kelly voted against both of them. By comparison, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, voted to confirm just 2 of those 19 picks. 3 other Senate Democrats may be worth noting as well. Like Gallego, they won in 2024 while their states voted for Trump. They are Senators Tammy Baldwin, Democrat of Wisconsin, Jackie Rosen, Democrat of Nevada, and Alyssa Slotkin, Democrat of Michigan. Slotkin, a freshman who won an open seat like Gallego did, and did so with a narrow plurality, showed the most early support for the Trump administration nominees. She voted to confirm 8 of the 19 key positions and voted against 10 others. Slotkin missed one of the votes. Rosen, who is beginning her second term, voted yes on 7 of the 19 picks. Baldwin voted on yes on 4 of 19 picks. In the other 41 nomination votes, Kelly and Gallego each voted yes on 10 of those 41 jobs. Even though the totals were the same, they often had different voting records. They disagreed on 6 of those 41 picks. That included 3 military jobs and 2 diplomatic positions. In 5 other votes, either Gallego didn't vote or Kelly didn't. One area of presidential confirmations that hasn't come into play for them yet this year is judicial nominations. The Trump administration has only begun to make nominations for the lifetime jobs, which must also pass Senate scrutiny. Here's how Kelly and Gallego have voted in 19 key presidential nominations this year. Secretary of State Marco Rubio both voted yes. He passed 99-0. CIA Director John Ratcliffe both voted yes. He passed 74-25. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth both voted no. He passed 51-50. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem both voted no. She passed 59-34. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent both voted yes. He passed 68-29. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy both voted yes. He passed 79-22. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum both voted yes, he passed 80-17. Energy Secretary Chris White, Geiga voted yes, Kelly voted no, Wright passed 59-38. Veterans Affairs Secretary Doug Collins, both voted yes, he passed 77-23. Attorney General Pam Bondi, both voted no, she passed 54-46. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Eric Turner, both voted no, he passed 55-44. Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vaught, both voted no, he passed 53-47. Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, both voted no, she passed 52-48. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., both voted no, he passed 52-48. Agricultural Secretary Brooke Rollins, Geiga voted yes, Kelly voted no, she passed 72-28. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, both voted no, he passed 51-45. FBI Director Kash Patel, both voted no, he passed 51-49. Education Secretary Linda McMahon, both voted no, she passed 51-45. Labor Secretary Lori Chavez de Ramer, both voted yes, she passed 67-32. We turn to today's featured story titled Overcoming Trauma, Bikers Against Child Abuse. After the bikers showed up, the kids could take control of their lives. By Lane Sainte. When Samantha was in sixth grade, she was too afraid to sleep. She was struggling in the aftermath of sexual abuse, and every night was a battle. Any attempt to drift off into dreams brought night terrors instead. She did not feel safe anymore, and though her abuser lived out of state, her peace seemed impossible to restore. Her parents, Missy and Tom, had tried everything. They would let Samantha climb into their bed at night, or they would go to hers. They built her bed up off the floor to help her feel like nobody could get to her. They slept in the corner of the room. They switched around rooms. They had a priest come out to bless the house. Samantha's therapist gave her a dream catcher. Nothing worked, Missy said. Nothing. Samantha was barely functioning. Her grades plummeted. Her struggles enveloped the family. She wasn't sleeping, so neither were her parents. Missy and Tom felt increasingly desperate, seeing their daughter in so much pain. Missy was a therapist, and they were willing to do anything to help Samantha. But they felt powerless in the face of her fear. They had burned through their sick time. Samantha wasn't getting any better. And they had another daughter to think about, too. I slept with her every night. Well, she wouldn't sleep, but I laid in bed with her, Missy said. And I was just dying. I was at the end of my rope. Then Samantha's therapist asked Missy, "Have you ever heard of Bikers Against Child Abuse?" Bikers Against Child Abuse, BACA to those in the know, was started in 1995 by a man named John Paul Liddy in Provo, Utah. Lily, a social worker and play therapist, was working with an 8-year-old boy who had been abused and was so afraid he wouldn't leave his house. The boy's fear seemed intractable even after therapy, so Lily turned to his own past for solutions. As a child, he was informally adopted into a group of Los Angeles bikers who gave him the road name Chief and helped him face his fears. Lily wondered if something similar would work for the boy. He brought him into his own biker circle, and it wasn't long before the boy ventured outside, once again able to expand his world. There were 27 motorcycles at the first ever BACA ride. The Utah chapter soon spawned a second in the state, and then expanded to Oklahoma, Missouri, Texas, and beyond. These days, BACA is an international nonprofit with chapters in 20 countries, including 4 in Arizona. Members go through a vetting process for at least a year before earning their patch. The longest-standing member in Arizona is Pam Musler, a.k.a. Nitro. She's a 67-year-old great-grandmother of two with a friendly smile and long hair. She's been around motorcycles her whole life, but doesn't ride herself. She hops on the back of her husband's bike instead. As she talks about the Maricopa County chapter and beyond, she tells constant stories about the kids she has encountered, the trauma they went through, and with an unmistakable sense of pride, how they're doing now. It's personal for Nitro. She had a tough time growing up, a life characterized by foster homes and abuse. She had a baby at 16 and went through hell to keep him. Nobody was there for me, she said, and I want to make sure I'm there for these kids. Children generally get connected to BACA through service providers like a therapist or social worker. If a child decides to participate, chapter members ride to their house in a dramatic convoy before hopping off, introducing themselves, and welcoming the child into the BACA family with a patch, a vest, and a road name of their own. Each child is assigned two primaries, bikers who will be there for them, over the phone or in person, whenever they need. That whenever is not just lip service, it's a promise BACA takes seriously. Introductions. Nobody is going to hurt you. When Samantha's therapist asked the question 13 years ago, Missy had not heard of BACA, nor had Tom. Now that they had, they weren't exactly jumping at the idea of inviting over a bunch of bikers to help their struggling daughter. I was like, immediate no, Tom said. Could we come up with a worse idea? Sleep-deprived and desperate. They couldn't come up with a better one either. The family agreed to an initial meeting. Two BACA members came over and sat down with Samantha and her sister, talking to the girls and sussing out what their road names might be. Samantha was dubbed Rhythm because she loved to dance. Samantha and her parents were being identified by first names only to protect their privacy. Then it was time for the introductory ride. The scene was captured by Republicport reporter Katrina Bland, who described Samantha chewing her lip nervously as the growl of motorbikes reverberated through a quiet East Valley neighborhood. Samantha, now 24, still remembers standing beside her dad, listening to the approaching bikes. I was so scared, she said. But the bikers who arrived en masse, dressed in leather and bandanas, were so kind they immediately set her at ease. Having them all turn up to support was empowering, she said. I don't think I'd ever felt that up to that point in my life. Still, her night terrors continued. She had not slept for easily 6 months, Tom said, and when I say she didn't sleep, I mean she did not sleep. At a breaking point, Tom and Missy turned to their unconventional new support system. Michael Musler, Nitro's husband, also known as Rembrandt, remembers the moment. They asked if there was anything BACA could think of, he said. We said, yeah, we know exactly what to do. One evening, Rembrandt and a few others rode over to Samantha's house. Listen, we're going to sit outside the house here all night, they told her. We're going to sit right on your front porch, and nobody is going to hurt you. The bikers chatted a little with Tom and Missy. Samantha brought them out some snacks, and the family went to sleep, and the BACA crew stayed outside, just like they had promised, taking shifts in the dark. Finally, Samantha slept. When she woke up the next morning, the first thing she did is she ran down to look out the window to make sure they were still there, Missy said. And they were still there. It was a revelation. Rembrandt remembers Missy in tears. Tom and Missy only called BACA to stand watch intermittently when Samantha was really struggling. They knew the bikers usually went off to work after their long shifts outside. They also knew if they asked, BACA would be there. No question. We tried to use them sparingly because I felt terrible for them, Tom said. But on the other hand, it worked. It felt like they had been climbing a mountain and finally reached the peak. The hard times weren't over, but maybe they were about to start coming down the other side. That really felt like family. BACA's constant presence was a big deal for Aiden Gregory and his mom, Sherry Knowles. They first encountered BACA when Aiden was 5. He had just been taken into the care of Sherry, who was his biological grandmother, and her husband, Carrie. Aiden's early years had been traumatic and tumultuous. He needed support. His counselor suggested BACA. Motorcycles weren't a foreign concept to Sherry and Carrie. They used to ride together in Scottsdale, Carrie at the handlebars, Sherry on the back. But BACA was something else. We are weekend bikers, Sherry said. They're real bikers. Aiden, now 19, doesn't remember the first meeting. He hid behind the table and fell asleep, Sherry said. but he does remember the bikers rolling up to Sherry's house to welcome him into the family. That's when he got his first Baca vest. He outgrew it in a few years and got another. Then he outgrew that one and got a third. That one doesn't fit him anymore, but he still has it. Nitro and another biker named Rock were his primaries, but over the years, Aiden got to know all of Baca. Everybody knew him, so everybody was his primary, Sherry said. Baca came to his baseball games, go-kart races, and birthday parties. More than once, Aiden found himself explaining to friends who all these bikers were. As he got older, contact grew less frequent, but Baca always made sure to check in and show up. Kerry died in 2021, 9 months after he was diagnosed with lung cancer. It was devastating for the entire family, and yet another tough blow for young Aiden. To Kerry, Aiden was his son. Blood didn't mean nothing to him, Sherry said. Aiden felt exactly the same way. They did everything together. Baseball, football, hanging out. It had been years since Baca first rolled up to greet Aiden, but once again, they showed up. Nitro and the whole crew were there at Kerry's memorial. They really felt like family, Aiden said. Support in court, a scary place for a child. Nitro is an encyclopedia of Baca antidotes, but there's research to back the program, too. In 2017, Baca was evaluated in a research paper published in the Journal of Evaluation and Program Planning. The study looked at 154 children who had participated in Baca. It found that 2 weeks after their first contact with the program, and again a year later, the kids had less emotional distress and conduct concerns, and had improved emotional and behavioral functioning. The researchers noted that Baca does not seek to replace clinical care. Members are neither therapists, nor police, nor vigilantes, but rather volunteers who want to help the child feel safe. The study had one major limitation. There was no control group, meaning the improvement in the Baca group could have been due to factors like maturity or the passage of time. Still, the authors wrote, the findings suggested promise in Baca's unique and adjunct services. These services included the initial ride, ongoing contact with primaries, and standing watch or providing security in certain cases. This can be for kids like Samantha, who just needed help to feel safe, or in cases where there's an active, ongoing threat. Baca also supports children who have to testify in court. Rembrandt sees that as a particularly important and potentially transformative part of the mission. It's terrifying for anyone, let alone a child, to have to tell their story in court, he said. But he said he also see it as an empowering moment that it allows a child to start moving on. I don't want to say put it behind them, Rembrandt said, but they've done what they need to do, and they feel powerful because of it. Rembrandt has been riding motorcycles since he was a teenager, but only got involved in Baca because of Nitro. She wanted him to join, but she needed access to a motorcycle to sign up. And as Rembrandt's involved too. I'm not a big joiner, Rembrandt said, but he relented for Nitro. After seeing the change Baca could elicit in a child, he knew he was in it for life. Once you witness that, and you're part of that, he said, there's no going back. Baca didn't just help Samantha sleep. After she disclosed her abuse, a rift erupted in her extended family on her mother's side and led to a painful estrangement. Unease ran through the community at her Catholic school. The way people treated her was hurtful and confusing. It seemed to contradict everything she had ever been told about how to react to abuse. Everyone says abuse is bad. Talk to adults about abuse, Samantha said. I remember thinking, why did I say anything? Her parents had said she had done the right thing, but that was hard to believe. They had to say that, right? They were her parents. Baca had no such obligation. They helped me recognize. Oh no, adults do care, Samantha said. Abuse is bad. I did nothing wrong. People will protect me. Things like that. They also stepped in when Samantha's family felt isolated and alone. They would turn up at her dance concerts and buy tickets to school fundraisers. They threw big holiday parties where the family could experience some festive cheer. When Samantha was hospitalized in her freshman year at risk of suicide, she felt embarrassed and ashamed. Baca sent her encouraging letters. Different bikers helped in different ways. Samantha got her nails done with her primary Sassy and texted back and forth with her about friends and school. Rembrandt made her feel safe, a deep, enduring comfort that lingers to this day. There was just something about knowing a big, tough biker is on your side, or at least someone who looks like one. To Samantha, Rembrandt was as sweet as he could be, but if someone just saw him, she said, they'd get a different impression. Don't mess with this guy. Every now and then, Tom and Missy turned to each other and wonder, how was it that these bikers were her biggest source of support? I'll be honest, I'm quite cynical, Tom said. I don't give a lot of praise unless it's valid. Baca has earned his respect. They said, we'll protect her. We'll offer support. We'll be here 24/7 if you need it. If you need us outside every night, we'll do that, he said. And they did. An enduring connection. When Aiden recently graduated from high school, Nitro came to the party. They took a photo together, beaming. Aiden is now studying business management at Grand Canyon University. He's living on campus, and though Sherry misses him, she's also a little stunned by how clean her house is. When Aiden graduates, he hopes to work for a company or maybe manage the Peoria body shop that Carrie used to run, which Sherry took over after he died. He also liked to own a fancy car. Which one? It's a long wish list, Aiden said, but just to keep it short and simple, like a Ferrari SF90. Sherry is extremely proud of him. He's overcome so much, she said. She often tells Aiden what happened to him doesn't define who he is. He gets to decide that. And if he wants to be a businessman, Sherry is certain he'll be a success. He's going to buy me a beach house somewhere, she joked, before the Ferrari. The best outcome, Nitro said, is when Baca helps a child understand they can take control of their own life. It's about empowerment, he said. We need to let them know they can stand up for themselves. If for some reason they don't need us anymore, that's great, she added. That's our goal. She loves it when they stay in touch. Like Aiden, Samantha has kept in contact. In 2023, she spoke at a Baca conference, and sometimes she comes across the group in training at work. These days, Samantha is a licensed master social worker, who provides therapy to first responders, couples, and children. A decade ago, earning an advanced degree would have been unthinkable. Samantha's trauma drove her grades down for years. Entering high school, she was convinced she was stupid and going nowhere fast. I was just going to be nothing and no one, she said. What turned it around? Her family, her therapist, and Baca. It didn't all get magically better after the biker showed up. That may have gotten the family to down the peak of the mountain, but it was a treacherous road down. There were highs and lows, a usually difficult freshman year, and lots of therapy. But over time, Samantha was able to feel safe again, to make sense of her experiences, and to channel them into a career where she can help others. Missy works in the office next door. Samantha thinks her professional training has helped heal her past self. She can feel it when she works with kids who went through the same thing she did. I hear what they say, and I'm like, I remember when I felt that way, she said. I think it helps me know that there's a light at the end of their tunnel, even if they can't see it. We finish hour one today with part of an article titled, Phoenix Proactive on Bus Stop Camping Tries to Keep Sites Clean, Accessible for Everyone, by Taylor Seeley. On an early weekday morning in April, two men and a woman camped at a bus stop a few blocks from Phoenix City Hall. A grocery cart with belongings blocked the sidewalk on Van Buren Street at 7th Avenue. Farther west, near 15th Avenue, another man and a woman lay asleep on the ground, the man's body wrapped around the leg of the bench. The next week, in West Phoenix at 27th Avenue and Indian School Road, two grocery carts with belongings piled up were parked just behind a bus stop around midday. It was the same story at the bus stop across the way. Another encampment with a grocery cart existed just behind the bus stop at 29th Avenue and Dunlop Road. These scenes are common around central Phoenix. Homelessness, though declining according to recent estimates, persists in the nation's fifth largest city. Bus stops are just one of many places unsheltered individuals make a home. Danny Hawkins, 60, was found resting on a bus stop bench along Central Avenue near Palm Lane. His bike and bike trailer were in front of him. He said he had been homeless for 13 years. It started after he injured his back and eventually had to quit his job. He had worked at a bakery where he had to lift heavy boxes, he said. He had been to shelters but found they were more trouble than they were worth. Hawkins has struggled with a handful of drug addictions over the years. Shelter and rehab, he said, exposed him to more drugs than the streets. You have to fall in line with the drug lords, Hawkins said. If you weren't doing drugs, you would be cast aside or caught in the crosshairs, he explained. The bus stop provided a respite from the pressure and a place to get healthy. While I'm rehabbing myself, this is where I feel safe and comfortable, Hawkins said. This is my reborn area. I started my new life here. If someone had sat next to Hawkins at the bus stop, they may have noticed he enjoys friendly banter and making friends. They have also noticed his rehabilitation was still in progress. A couple tin foil squares with drug residue littered the ground near his feet. The blues are easier to get off of and helped him stay off other drugs, he said, explaining his occasional fentanyl use. What is Phoenix doing about bus stop encampments? Phoenix city officials don't believe bus stop encampments are getting worse or are particularly problematic. Public Transit Director Jesus Sapien, who has worked at the city for 20 years, said he thought the worst period was 2 or 3 years ago. He estimated his team had to address problems at bus stops 2 or 3 times a week back then, as opposed to roughly twice a month these days. That's not to say it's not happening, but I think we've been very proactive, Sapien said. Where there are issues, he explained, it's usually in downtown or central Phoenix or on high-trafficked major streets. Sapien said he thought issues in encampments probably make up a very small proportion of the city's 4,100 bus stops. There isn't a way to confirm those instincts. Phoenix doesn't track its bus stop contacts or number of complaints submitted, Sapien and Phoenix Police Transit Commander Leif Meyer said. I'll have to leave it there for Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 11th, 2025. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli, wishing you a happy Mother's Day, thanking you for listening to Hour 1, and encouraging you to stay tuned for Hour 2 and our other great programs here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.